Alpine Authors on Park Radio. A look at some of the great books being written by and for the Bow Valley.
Hi, and welcome to Alpine Authors. I'm Alan Buckingham. Anyone who's driven west of Lake Louise on the Trans-Canada Highway towards Field, British Columbia, will have driven by two of Canada's most interesting railway features, the Spiral Tunnels and the Big Hill. This year is the 100th anniversary of the opening of the Spiral Tunnels, so it's fitting that we take a look at a book featuring this engineering marvel. Joining me now is Graham Pohl, author of The Spiral Tunnels and The Big Hill. Hi, Graham, and welcome to Alpine Authors.
Hi, Alan. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, to start off, I was hoping you'd be able to give a brief description of the Spiral Tunnels for those who aren't really aware and familiar with them.
Okay, the Spiral Tunnels are, as you said, on the hill between the Continental Divide, west of Lake Louise, and Field in British Columbia. And together, the two tunnels create a kind of three-dimensional figure eight within two mountainsides and an adjoining section of straight track. So the trains actually spiral up or down as they ascend or descend the grade on what used to be known as the Big Hill. And the tunnels in their design effectively double the length of track on the hill. So by doubling the length of the track, you reduce the grade by half. So it took the grade of the original track, which had a maximum grade of 4.5%, which is equivalent to, if you think in meters, every 100 meters you travel, the track changes elevation 4.5 meters. Or in railway terms, people usually think in feet, so 100 feet, 4.5 feet. It took it down to 2.2%, so it reduced the grade by half. 2.2% is still considered extreme for a railway, but it obviously resulted in considerable cost savings and safety for the Canadian Pacific Railway in traveling this route.
It's a pretty interesting feature and something that is not necessarily common for railways. But there's more than just the tunnels in the book. How did you decide what you wanted to put into the book?
Yeah, the book covers a lot of things connected with the hill itself, with Yoho National Park and Field, British Columbia, and to an extent to Lake Louise. And also to set the background for the construction of the tunnels, I needed to tell a bit of the story about how the Canadian Pacific Railway came into being. So the book starts with John A. Macdonald and his push to create Canada's first transcontinental railway, which started in the early 1870s, soon after Confederation. It really took about 14 years to come to fruition. So that's the background for the book. And then it needed to actually describe the construction of the railway through the mountains, the original grade, the Big Hill grade. It needed to describe the logistics and some of the stories that went with that construction. And then as a sideline to the construction of the railway, the tourism industry developed in the Rockies when Canadian Pacific built its hotels, and the very first one, actually, and most people are surprised, they think that the Banff Springs might have been the first, but Mount Stephen House in Field was actually the first of its mountain hotels, opened in the fall of 1886, and Glacier House in Rogers Pass opened a couple of months later. The Banff Springs didn't open until a couple of years later. So the tourism industry developed. And then there's a lot of tales with railway operations on the hill, and I had to tell those. And then for the real railway fanatics, I also wanted to include photos of modern day and older locomotives and some technical details about them, because train buffs like their trains and like a lot of details. So the book tries to cover all that general interest stuff and some specific interest stuff. And one of the great pleasures was this is the second edition of the book, so I included many of the photographs that were in the first edition, but I expanded the book pretty much 50%, and therefore was able to include many more photographs and stories. And as I was saying, one of the great pleasures was looking for photographs and finding them and matching them up with things to tell about the Spiral Tunnels and the Big Hill. So even those who may not think they're interested in history can probably pick up this book and find little nuggets about Canadian history, about Rocky Mountain history, and about railway history in general.
Now, you mentioned having to do some research to find the photographs. It must have taken you a lot of research to just even get the text into the book, too. How long did that take, and how did you go about doing it? Like, where did you look?
This book has an interesting genesis. I actually, the first edition, started writing it in 1992 and spent about a year plugging away at the text, and the publisher I was working with at the time decided they didn't want to do it. So then we were going to self-publish the book, and then the publisher decided they were going to do it. So the book came out in 1996. So I would say the initial version of the book took about a year of, not all the time working on it, but about a year of putting it together. The new edition I spent most of the autumn of 2008 working on it. And most of the running text is carried over from the first edition, so I didn't do a lot of extra research that way. I did some fact-checking and made some corrections. There's a lot of sidebar and photo caption text that is new. And that, I have to say that for writers and researchers, you do have to be careful with the internet what you're relying on. But when you find stuff that is good, it really has made the job of writing and researching a lot easier than it used to be. For instance, all of the new photos in this book I found by internet searching, and then contacting the archives that hold the photos, or in some cases private collections of people who hold the photos, and asking for permission to use them. And I also discovered some documents from the original construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway, one of which was written in 1885, which, you know, if you'd have known to look for it, if you'd have known it existed, it would have meant a trip to Ottawa 15 years ago to find it. But somebody had, in the interim, had made that trip to Ottawa and scanned it and put it online, word for word. So, you know, I double-checked the fact that I was looking at the proper document, and it wasn't somebody's version of what had been written. And once you know you've got the original thing online, then you don't have to leave home to do a lot of your research. It's just a matter of knowing where to look, what you're looking for, and in the process you'll come up with some tremendous surprises, left turns and right turns that take you where you didn't think you were going to go, but they're essential parts of the story eventually, and it's a kind of a serendipitous process, and a very enjoyable one at that, too.
Now, as you mentioned, you start off the book with some of the history about the Canadian Pacific Railway. Can you talk a bit about the run-up to laying the track over Kicking Horse Pass?
Yeah, the run-up to laying track across Kicking Horse Pass began in the early 1870s with what was in those days called the Pacific Railway. And it was championed by John A. Macdonald for his first term in government, and later, and to with less force, by Alexander Mackenzie's government when they took over from John A. Macdonald's government. And basically, the first 11 years or so of the idea of the railway involved politicians bickering about where it would go, how much it would cost, and all this sort of thing, while surveyors surveyed route after route to which there was no political commitment. So basically a decade was squandered. And then finally, in 1881-82, Macdonald managed to arrange a private, what was called syndicate of, they called it the syndicate, of backers to fund the railway. And this is what became known as the Canadian Pacific Railway Company in 1882. So the government had started building track west from basically Port Moody, and the Fraser Canyon in the 1870s, and was building track east from Thunder Bay, what's now Thunder Bay, to sort of join BC to the rest of Canada. But there was this big hole in the middle across the prairies and through the mountains of Alberta, BC, which is what essentially the Canadian Pacific Railway Company took on. The government was on the hook to complete the railway in 10 years, which was its promise in 1871 to the province of BC, and obviously failed on that. So when the Canadian Pacific Railway Company received its charter in 1882, they were also charged with the task of completing the railway within 10 years. And they managed to do it in half that time, which was a bit of a miracle considering what they were up against and the way they ran out of money. Everybody grossly underestimated how much it would cost to build the railway in the mountains to move supplies and men and equipment into areas that were largely unexplored, and to produce a technically acceptable railway grade in very hospitable terrain. So the whole background, there's a lot of stories in there, some great names in Canadian history involved with it, Sandford Fleming being one of them, the first engineer in chief of the Pacific Railway, who left a tremendous mark in Canadian science and technology, and who I describe him as in the book as cutting a dashing blend between citizen of Parliament Hill and backwoods traveler of Alberta and BC. He would go out and walk the grades of the railway line in the mountains and then go back to Parliament to report on his findings. And Fleming was a great worker in that regard, but the politicians he was reporting to didn't really appreciate that, and they were more into their political stripes than honoring his work. And Fleming, at the time, in his day, was actually disgraced over the way the budget for the railway was handled and that. But we remember him now, of course, for his work with Canadian postage stamps and universal time and all those things, which and many other things which he contributed to both Canadian science and technology and industry, and also to the world.
Now, we've got to take a bit of a break here, but when we get back, I want to talk to you a bit more about the process of building the railway through the mountains.
Alpine Authors on Park Radio will be right back. Now back to Alpine Authors, only on Park Radio, 101.1 FM.
Hi, and welcome back to Alpine Authors. I'm Alan Buckingham. This week I'm talking with Graham Pohl, author of The Spiral Tunnels and The Big Hill. So Graham, I was wondering how you got interested in the spiral tunnels.
I used to live in Field. I lived in Field from 1985 till 1998. And an outfit called the Friends of Yoho, which basically had about the same birth date as the Friends of Banff, came into being in the late 1980s. And the manager of the Friends of Yoho saw a need for information on the spiral tunnels. There's the viewpoint on Highway 1, and a lot of people would stop at the information center in Field and ask for a pamphlet or a book or something to help them understand what they'd just been looking at. Because when you stop at the viewpoint, you don't get the three-dimensional view. You can see one of the tunnels, and if you know where to look, you can see the portal of the upper tunnel. But you don't get a total picture of how the tunnels actually work. So she suggested I write a pamphlet, which the Friends of Yoho was going to sell. And that pamphlet became a book. So being local and being interested in the history, I was probably a logical choice for the project, and it really took off.
Yeah, that's one hell of a pamphlet you ended up writing. Did you ever do any pamphlet sort of thing, or did you just end up doing the book?
No, it soon ballooned way beyond that.
So now, we were talking before the break about how it was the mountains that caused the most trouble. How did they decide on a route through the mountains for the railway?
Sandford Fleming had chosen Yellowhead Pass, which is in what's now Jasper National Park, originally as the route for the railway. And when Fleming fell out of favor because of the way the project had been handled, that was sort of taken away. And even though the rails were being laid from the east and the west towards the mountains, nobody actually knew how they were going to cross and where. So the first choice was how to get over the Rocky Mountains, and the Kicking Horse Pass was chosen on the advice of Major Albert Fulman Rogers, a U.S. Railway surveyor who William Cornelius Van Horn, the manager of the Canadian Pacific Railway, had hired. And that choice resulted in the Big Hill, the 4.5% grade. Rogers had staked a grade down the west slope of Kicking Horse Pass, which kept to 2.2%, which was the maximum that the railway was supposed to have anywhere in Canada, according to its charter. But when it came time to actually build the track, the railway company had the charter changed so that they could run the rail straight down and fix the problem later. It took them 25 years to actually get around to fixing the problem. And the second problem was how to get over the Selkirk Mountains. And the rails used Rogers Pass, what's now known as Rogers Pass, named again after Major Albert Bowman Rogers. But the two passes put together created railway grades that are excessively steep for any kind of railway operations, particularly for the coal and cordwood fired locomotives that initially ran them, and also through phenomenal terrain plagued by avalanches, debris flows, any kind of thing that can fall onto the tracks or undermine the tracks happens in the Rockies and Selkirks. And for instance, in the Selkirks, just in crossing Rogers Pass, the railway track bisects 139, the original railway track bisected 139 avalanche paths in the space of about 11 miles. So just tremendous problems to deal with. So the Canadian Pacific Railway had to come up with solutions on the spot, snow sheds, tunnels, trestles. In some cases, they built the track on trestles that they knew were going to get knocked out by slides, so then they would just rebuild the trestles to keep the track open. Rather than trying to stop the slide coming down, they just acknowledged that it would take out the track, and basically annually, and then rebuilt the rails. So there were lots of logistical and technical challenges, and the men, and it was men. I have found no instance of women being employed in these enterprises. The men doing this work were housed in boxcars or in tents at trackside. In what was really the wilds of Canada at the time, the closest settlements would have been Fort Calgary or Fort Kamloops. So they wouldn't get to town necessarily every year. And they were really roughing it and in ways that we probably can't grasp today.
It sounds like an incredible process, and it must have taken a whole lot of people to actually carry this out. Do you how many people were employed for the Canadian Pacific Railway?
The number that I've seen for construction through the Rockies in 1884, the track reached just west of Lake Louise in December of 1883, and so they crossed Kicking Horse Pass and went through Kicking Horse Valley and the Columbia Valley to just shy of the climb to Rogers Pass in 1884. 4,000 men worked on that 75-mile stretch of railway grade in that year. And they required 1,200 horses and mules to move just their supplies to and from. And the supplies were moved along what was called the tote road, which was a road, the track basically roughed out of the muck, usually fairly close to the railway grade itself, which was also being excavated or built up, depending on the terrain. All of the materials that the men used had to be packed in by mule and horse. And there was also sort of a sub-logistic there that the horses and mules needed feed, too, so that had to be packed in. So you've got this kind of pyramid of for every mile that you need to take some supplies, you've got more input into actually taking the supplies there. And there reaches a point where it costs you more to actually build the track in that direction than you can possibly think of recovering in terms of the money you're spending on building each mile of track. And the railway was up against that in 1884, 85. They were running out of money and spending it at more than $1 million a month. So some of the things that people ate, there's one requisition. It's in the book. It comes from the general store at what was called Holt City at the time, which is now the Valley Bottom settlement at Lake Louise. And when you look at the 30 or so things that are listed as supplies for 1 month for a crew of seven, 125 pounds of bacon, 26 pounds of sugar, a case of canned plums. It's kind of, you wonder why. Well, maybe it goes with the 6 pounds of cheese, 30 pounds of oatmeal, 25 pounds of beans, a pound of hops, a package of salt, peas, corn, raisins, soap, half a barrel of corned beef, 10 pounds of tea, 5 pounds of coffee, a keg of syrup. Not much in the way of vitamin C.
Not much in the way of vegetables, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, these guys are eating out of boxes and tins, which, of course, be the only way the stuff could be packed along in those conditions and survive. And there are tales, of course, of horses dunking in rivers, and what you're hoping would be tea turns out to be a, you know, a mashy pulp when it gets to you and things like that. So they were really roughing it. And it must have been a good day when the pack train came in with the supplies. You're probably looking forward to it for weeks.
Oh, absolutely. Now, when the railway was first completed in 1885, it followed what's called the Big Hill section. What's this big deal about the Big Hill? You mentioned the grade thing. How is that an issue?
It's steep for a railway in many ways. If a railway is being built today, the surveyor and construction engineers try and keep the grade to less than 1%. So for every 100 meters or feet or miles or whatever you travel, the change in distance is one. So you travel 100 meters, the change in elevation is one or less meter. Once you get above that, the fuel use of course goes up. Braking, which with diesel electric locomotives today requires fuel, goes up. The cost of wear and tear on your machinery goes up, and the safety factor goes up, and also the cost of maintaining the track go up, because it takes more abuse on a steep grade. Now, in the 1880s, when they had the 4.5% grade on the Field Hill, after they built it, they didn't even know if they had a locomotive powerful enough to go up and down it. So they actually ran a test in the winter of 1884-85, where they got a locomotive down the field, down the hill to field, and put a few railway cars behind it and stocked it up and see if it could get up the hill. And the first one was powered by cordwood, firewood basically, and it couldn't do it. And then they brought in a coal burning unit and they got it up the hill. So 4.5%, I mean, when you're driving on the Field Hill between Lake Louise and Field these days, and you say you're going west from Lake Louise, you crest the top of the hill there, just past Wapta Lake, and you start down, you're on the 4.5% grade right there. So that's 4.5%. And in a car or a truck, you know, you notice it. It's fairly steep. But think of a railway train today, which a 106-car coal train with 3, 4, 5 locomotives on it, it can weigh 14,000 tons. And think of the momentum of trying to get that down a grade only half that steep safely, keeping it at the right speed and on the curves, and pulling it to a stop at field. And you can start to appreciate some of the difficulty and the danger and the expense that comes with operating a railway in those locations.
Absolutely. So this is why they decided to build the spiral tunnels. How did they decide that was the best way to fix the problem?
They thought of many options. As early as the early 1900s, they'd been thinking of tunneling right from the crest of the Continental Divide right down to field. And actually, the tunnel would have come out west of field, but decided that was too expensive. Some of the CP, Canadian Pacific design engineers, knew of locations in Europe and one in the United States where tunnels that spiraled in mountainsides had been used. Never two that make a figure eight like this, but in one location in Switzerland, there were two tunnels a little ways apart from each other that had been used to take the grade up or down, depending which way the train was traveling, at a more acceptable rate. So it was decided that they could construct these two tunnels partway down the field hill and thereby double the length of track and half the grade. And they practiced laying out the plan for the tunnels out on the prairies on the flat. They staked out everything to the inch and planned it all out before they transcribed their plans into mountain terrain. And when you think of the surveying that was involved in getting these tunnels plotted and then transferring that to railway grade in the mountains and tying in with an existing track, like you have to come on to the spiral tunnel grade reduction at a certain point and come off it at a certain point to tie in with the less steep sections of the old Big Hill grade. Just a phenomenal engineering feat for 1906, 1907, 1908, 1909, which is when the work was carried out. And they built the tunnels. Each tunnel was bored from each end simultaneously, so in sort of a westerly heading and an easterly heading in each tunnel. And when they met, the error of alignment in each tunnel was less than 2 inches in each tunnel, which is just, you know, incredible to think. I can't get my head around that kind of thing today, but people 100 years ago were quite capable, and I think we tend not to give them, the people of that era, the credit for doing the work they did without the sophisticated means that we have these days.
Absolutely. It's an incredible story, and it's actually an incredible thing to watch as well. And there's all kinds of more interesting stories in the book. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But thank you, Graham, so much for sharing some of the story with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I really appreciate being on your program.
Well, that's it for the show this week. If you missed part of the interview or just want to listen to it again, you can download the show by heading to friendsofbanff.com and clicking the podcast link. If you'd like to pick up a copy of Graham's book, The Spiral Tunnels in the Big Hill, visit The Bear and the Butterfly at 214 Banff Avenue. Alpine Authors can be heard every week at this time on Park Radio. Tune in next week to hear from another Alpine author.
Alpine Authors, only on Park Radio, 101.1 FM.